Welcome to Everyone Loves Guitar, where we sit down and talk with interesting professional guitar players and other musicians, uncover their life stories, and discover what makes them tick. If you love guitar, music, and the backstory of people's lives, then stick around. You're in the right place. If you, like the rest of America, are looking to move down here to the Tampa Bay area in Florida and you want to work with a realtor who knows the area well, then make sure you reach out to Ann at West Florida Real Estate. Ann has sold over 350 homes here in the Bay Area over the last 6 years. She's smart, she's lived in the area for 16 years, and you won't find anyone around with a better work ethic. Reach out to her at Ann with an E at westfloridarealestate.com and let her know you heard about her here on Everyone Loves Guitar. That's Ann with an E at westfloridarealestate.com. For information on advertising, go to everyonelovesguitar.com/advertise. And if you're enjoying the show and you'd like to support it, go to everyonelovesguitar.com/support. Hey, everybody, this is Craig Garber from Everyone Loves Guitar. And we've got just a super cool guy and a great player and someone who's really gotten to experience the success as a musician that really very few people do. I'm with Richard Fortus, the guitar player from Guns N' Roses. Rich was born and raised in St. Louis. He got started with music really early by studying violin at age 4 and drums at age 5. He studied at the Conservatory of the Arts in St. Louis and at Southern Illinois University, and he also played with various youth symphonies in St. Louis. His first band was called The Eyes in 1984, and they released a single called Freedom in a Cage while developing a cult following in the Midwest through extensive touring. In 1990, they changed their name to Pale Divine, and they signed with Atlantic Records, releasing Straight to Goodbye in 91. Pale Divine toured supporting the Psychedelic Furs, beginning a long-standing relationship between Richard and the Furs singer Richard Butler. In 1992, Richard joined the Furs on tour again, this time as a member. And then Richard and both Richards formed a band on their own called Love Spit Love. Great band, by the way. Their eponymous album was released in 1994, and their second album, which is a really cool title, Try Some, Eat Some, was co-written and co-produced by Richard Fortus, and the two Richards still work together to this day. In the late 90s, Richard began a collaboration with composer and artist BT. They've recorded film scores, records, and they also toured together in 2000. Around this time, he was becoming a very in-demand first-call session player in New York City, and he also became a partner in the music production company called Compound, where he's provided music for TV commercials and show themes, movie trailers, video games, industrial films, and more. Also during this time, Richard worked with photographer Michael Halsband and provided a soundtrack to the film Surf Movie. In 2001, Richard joined legendary rock band Guns N' Roses, and he began touring with the band and recording for the band's long-awaited Chinese Democracy record. They've played sold-out shows on nearly every continent in front of millions of fans. During his Guns N' Roses downtime over the last 10 years, Richard has performed or recorded with Enrique Iglesias, Rihanna, Thin Lizzy, Nina, Angela McCluskey, Jesse Malin, Fiona Apple, The Crystal Method, and others. He's also recorded soundtracks for Repo, the genetic Opera, Role Models, Monster, and The Fast and the Furious. In 2013, Richard joined the Dead Daisies, a supergroup featuring John Stevens from NXS and David Lowie from Mink. The bands opened for ZZ Top, Aerosmith, Alice in Chains, Jane's Addiction, and many other top bands in 2013. Their first headlining tour was in February of 2014 in Australia, and it was a resounding success, leading to opening gigs in the U.S. for Kiss, amongst other artists. Also in 2014, the Face I Love EP was released, and that was Richard's first studio work with the band. In November, Richard will be touring the Far East, the Middle East, and South Africa with Guns N' Roses. Richard, man, thank you so much for your time. I appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Yeah, you're welcome. You started studying off violin and drums, and I was curious why those instruments in particular and what prompted you to switch to guitar?
Violin, the Suzuki method, was just coming into popularity when I was about that age. So, and they were starting kids really young. My parents got me involved in that, and so I rolled with that. And then my grandparents bought me a drum kit, much to the chagrin of my parents. And Yeah, so I got into that, and that sort of quelled the rock and roll side of me while I was still playing in different orchestras and stuff with violin, and then started playing cello later on as well. But yeah, I carried on playing drums, drums and violin all through school until I was about 12, and then picked up a guitar. And there were always guitars around my house because my father was involved in the MI side of the industry. So he was working for a company that made musical instruments. So St. Louis Music, which was Crate, Ampeg, Alvarez, Electra guitars when I was a kid. So there were always guitars in the house,
very cool.
But I was very intimidated by them because they had six strings and very long necks and polyphonic, and I had my hands full with four. So it was very intimidating. So I never really got into it until I was about 12 or 13 and started picking guitar up.
That's really cool that, to hear that you were intimidated by guitar.
Yeah.
I mean, just because you're such a great guitar player now. So, I mean, for anybody listening, you know, I mean, it's like, and for me to hear, it's interesting, you know?
Yeah. Well, I mean, when you think about it, when you're a kid, and you're like focusing, because violin is predominantly single note, you know, especially in classical, it's single note lines, you know? So the idea of piano still is it. Like, I can't believe how pianists can sit down and sight read music. That just blows my mind with two hands. It's still difficult for me to get my head around, but you know, it was the same type of thing with guitar. It was like, man, reading chords and I had just a lot to deal with.
Well, it worked out good.
Maybe, who knows? Maybe piano. Maybe my next adventure will be piano.
Plan B, man. There you go.
No, I had to play piano in school and stuff, but the idea of people that can just sit down and, because they're always the best sight readers, right? Pianists are.
Yeah, there's a lot going on. There's so many notes.
How do they do that?
I don't know, man. What was I've interviewed a lot of people, and they all said, I thought my life was set once I got a record deal. And many of them, it was just a heap of trouble. So I was curious, what was the most important thing you learned from your experience signing your first record deal with Atlantic? And how did that help you navigate the business end of the industry moving forward?
You know, I think that I never viewed a record deal as the be all end all, like, you know, now I'm successful. It was just the next step. And at that point in the world and in the business, the next step, you signed with an indie and then shift to a major, or you had to sign with a major and, you know, hope for the best and try and make the most of it to get to, you know, any type of success. And I realized that nobody in the industry really gives a shit about you. You know, there's just because they signed you at that point, they were throwing shit against the wall, right? It was just, and they would just roll with whatever stuck, but they would throw as much shit against the wall as they could. They had money coming in. It wasn't like they had to be careful with their investments. They were signing up anything that looked like it had regional success and they could, you know, would expand to a national level with a little help. And what I saw, and that's what I learned, is that nobody really cared about you, you know?
So you knew this back then, even when they signed you?
I learned it very quickly. Yeah.
Did that in a way, like in some weird way, take stress off of you? As a player?
No. If anything, it adds it, because you've got to win over an audience every night. You know, you've got to blow people away because nothing else is going to help you. You know, nobody else is going to do it for you. Mm. You know, and obviously, there were situations where that did happen. You know, guys wrote hit songs that connected with people for whatever reason, or they had a video that connected with people or something, you know, that got legs on its own, that got the interest of a company to get behind and start, okay, now let's go with this. This is, you know, it looks like this is going to stick. Let's push that.
Sure.
And then there were the bands that slugged it out in clubs every night and built their following that way, you know, and just won people over every night. And that's really what we had been doing and what I figured we would continue to do and build on a national level.
Hmm. Thanks.
Which now it seems is the way you have to do it.
Oh, know? Yeah.
So I think that grassroots type of, when you build a base in that way, it's solid. You know, it's just, that's a solid foundation, because those people will stick with you.
Yeah, for sure. You don't have a choice now, like you said. You know, it's social media, and you right. know, how much can you promote through your social media channels, which is pretty much it, which is, you know, in a way, a blessing and a curse.
Yeah. It, but you know, with the advent of the internet, you really leveled the playing field was leveled.
Yes.
And everybody had a shot. You didn't have to be, if you had outstanding music, you didn't have to be good looking. You didn't have to have a video that looked great. You know, you could, and in a way that's great. And in a way that sucks, because there's no filters. So everything becomes more niche, you know, and it's difficult for me to find music that I love now, you know, but I do, I mean, it's there. It's just, it's always been there. You know, people talk about, oh, there's no great music like there used to be great bands. That's bullshit. I mean, there is, there's yeah. tons of great bands. There's people that still, man, it's a disease that has infected generation after generation, you know, this love of music and that desire to get in a room with other guys and make noise, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, it's true. It has leveled the playing field, because now, like, you're right, you don't have to be good looking. You don't have to, if you can appeal to enough people, you know, the downside of that is most musicians are terrible at marketing, and that, you know, so it's yeah. forced them to sort of like, deal with the reality of, I need to get good at this quick, or
it's always been that way. You've always had to be able to create your art and then step outside of that and look at it and go, okay, now how do I exploit this? Don't you think? I think it's always been that way. You have to be able to sell it. You know, you've got to be able to, without it affecting you as an artist,
right?
You know, you've got to be able to create your art and then separate yourself from that and go, okay, now what do I do with it?
Yeah. Yeah.
I sell this. How do I exploit it? How do I get this to as many people, and how do I make it as, you know, and I think it's always been that way. And the artists that were able to do that were the ones that succeeded. The best musicians and the best artists in the world are the ones that are sitting in a basement somewhere, you know? I really believe that. I mean, the best players I know are not gigging.
Interesting. You know, the only thing is, in the past, where the musicians had the label, there was only one method of distribution. Mm-hmm. So if you had the connection into that, if you got a record label signing you, your hands were free. That was, quote, their job. You know, and sure, they would ask you to do promos and stuff, but the burden of...
Yes and no. I mean, but that's, I mean, in some cases that happened, but I never felt that...
You kept pushing at the grassroots.
...at my disposal to make, you know, but I never felt like it was now somebody else's problem, you know? And I always felt like it was... At the end of the day, I was the one that was going to have to get people to get involved in it, you know, and everybody, and Axel's that way, you know, he's involved in his own business. You know, that's, everybody is. Slash is, you know, the, the guys from the Psychedelic Furs were, you know, they're very careful releasing what they're putting out, what they're and how they're presenting it.
So let me ask you this, because this is like honestly one of the first times I'm hearing that. So I'm wondering, is this part of the reason why you guys are in the echelon you're in? Because you didn't sit and say, you know, because you continue to carry the ball on your back and say and not say, okay, I got a record company now, it's up to them. You continue to be vested in this and saying, fuck, we got to push this thing. And you know what I'm saying? I wonder if
why isn't the record company doing this? Why aren't, and then it's a matter of working with them and going, hey, you know, we're seeing this. Why aren't you guys seeing this at this angle? You know, because a lot of times they're seeing things from a different vantage point. So they don't see what you're seeing as the artist. They're not seeing the reaction of people's faces when you play a certain song. They're not seeing what fans are relating to as far as the artwork on your t-shirts or whatever. You know, they're not seeing that. So you've got to present, you've got to work with them. You know, you've got to, you know what I mean?
I totally know what you mean. This
totally
is
different
just
angles, and you got to work with them.
Have you always been like that as far as like,
yes.
Yeah. Okay. So no, but
since I was playing clubs with my first band, I mean, going out and putting flyers out and again, assessing, looking at what your audience is responding to, you know, and what things are turning them on and, you know, giving them more of that or pushing it more or seeing what they how they react to the opening band or to the band that's playing after you, you know, and go, well, man, that, you know, something like that would be cool. You know, like, why aren't we doing something like that? Or, you know, I'm constantly looking for inspiration in that way, you know?
So you're always looking for, so you're running this like I run my businesses or any other business person does. You're looking for angles that you can get in. You're looking for other ideas that work. And then how do you take them and put them into your thing?
Right. But then you've got to be able to separate that. And it's a very delicate balance because you don't, if you can't go and say, okay, well, I need a song like this.
Right.
Because it just doesn't work. It's not going to be believable. It's not going to be. And really, I mean, ultimately, for me, at least, the stuff that I am drawn to artistically, to the stuff that I want to listen to, is stuff that is believable. I have to believe it. If I go see a band, man, 9 times out of 10, I don't believe the singer. I think he's faking it. He's, you know. It's you know what I mean? What turns me on. I don't care if the songs I want to believe it. I have to believe it.
And when you say believe it, you mean it's got to be authentic.
It's got to be authentic.
Yeah, okay.
I have to believe that person feels that it's real. That the music is coming from a genuine place, you know. And I know what that negates in a way what I said before, but it doesn't. You have to be able to separate them.
Yeah.
You know, your art from your business.
Man, I totally get that. Yeah. It's just it's really good to hear that because a lot of people I've spoken to haven't, you know, they had a bit of an old mentality. And maybe I'm wondering, just kind of thinking out loud, is that, you know, is there a reason why you guys are at that level and maybe they weren't because they did abdicate some of that responsibility to the record company label? You know, it's almost like saying, you know, you get married and you say, you know, you put the burden of getting along on your wife and you're not, you know, you're not going to be involved. And I mean, that's the same thing in a sense, you know, if you're not going to participate, man, it ain't going to work.
That's right.
Yeah. Interesting, man. Thank you. You spent time with Richard Butler and it was really productive for you. You played, wrote, produced, and you guys made some great music together. What was the most important things you learned from that experience?
man, he is. Okay, first of all, I was a huge Furs fan when I was growing up. When I started, I was real prog type stuff at that point. So bands like Yes and King Crimson and like, you know, Peter Gabriel era, Genesis and, you know, that was, and then like more of the art rock like Bowie and T-Rex and Velvet Underground and Roxy Music, you know, stuff like that. Mm. I was really intrigued by. And then I didn't listen to, I wasn't into like Motley Crue or Poison or Def Leppard or bands like that that were popular, Ozzy Osbourne. But I loved like the early Sabbath stuff. I loved like the, I just was like attracted more to older music. And then I heard The Clash. My whole world was like, whoa, okay, hold
say,
on.
Say that last part again. You heard The Clash and then who? It just broke up for a second. You heard The Clash?
I heard The Clash and everything changed for me. Like it my whole world went, because it was before that it was all about, like I was really into Mob, Vision Orchestra and Jeff Beck and Return to Forever and, you know, all those, the fusion thing that was happening, you know, like later, like the Electric Period Miles, like with that, you know, like Get Up With It and On the Corner and Bitches Brew, like, and then when that became Mahavishnu, and like to me that was Mahavishnu was like punk rock, right? You know, they like had chips on their shoulder and they were out to prove themselves, you know. And that's the same thing, that energy and that passion is what attracted me to The Clash and to the Sex Pistols and to the Ramones, and it was so immediate and so raw and pure, you know. And that really attracted me. And also, I think ignorance so often breeds innovation. And there was a simplicity and ignorance that was very, you know, that made that so pure and genuine. And again, you know, I need to believe it.
Yeah.
And, you know, same thing with Sonic Youth, same thing with Fugazi or, you know, Minor Threat and Black Flag, you know, like when I heard all this, that's where my life went, you know, musically. And then it was not about being a virtuoso player. And for years, you know, we hid that as much as we could. And it was more about the subtleties, you know, where you let that shine for a second, you know, but don't focus on it. You know, and so that's sort of the direction that I went in. And the Furs were a huge influence on me. I mean, Talk, 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 that album really affected me. And was at that time, man, they were one of my favorite bands. I saw the Forever Now tour when I was, man, I must have been 14, 15.
Wow.
I saw so many great bands around that time, yeah.
This is in St. Louis?
Yeah, yeah. I remember cool. I saw them at the same place that I saw The Replacements open for X. I saw Bad Brains, a Circle Jerk, saw everybody there.
Those are all super high energy bands, man. It seems like that was your thing.
Well, bear in mind, I'm coming into my teenage years. I'm like 15, you know.
Yeah. So you're going nuts with hormones and you're like,
yeah. But yeah, so Richard was that was one of my favorite bands, the Furs. So when my band signed a deal, that was one of the bands that I was like, okay. And I mean, I wrote a letter to John Ashton. I wrote a physical letter, and a friend of mine in New York worked at a music at Rogue Music, and they sold him gear. So that was my in, right? So I got the address and sent him a letter, a physical letter. I wrote to their agent, you know, and said, and this is, you know, we were signed to Atlantic.
Yeah.
I'm like, hey, I'm my band just, here's a copy of a record. We signed with Atlantic. I'm a huge fan. You know, same thing with the agent. Love to tour with you guys. And that's
so cool. So that's how you hooked up.
Yes. Yeah.
So they responded to that. They checked it out and they were like, hey, this is cool.
Yeah. I don't know how it came through. I think the agent. And so then when the guitar player heard about it, he's like, oh, yeah. I know that band. Yeah. You know, it's
that's, I think, so it's cool. Like
that. Now, what's fucked up is I ended up taking that guy's job, and you know, he hated me for years.
That doesn't make you a bad person.
Actually, that's not exactly true, but
that's so wild. Man, that is really cool. Yeah, talk about that's good hustle, man.
But you sort of have to, you know?
I agree, but not a lot of people do that. I mean, of the average just of the population, you know, for the most part, work is kind of like a dirty four-letter word. You know, I'm not picking on anybody specifically, but
I guess so. You know, I think that, you know, after I moved to New York, I joined the Furs and joined, and then did Love Spit Love. And during that, a lot of changes, because I think socially and musically, as far as my history of music, my knowledge of the history of music, I could relate to producers. So if a producer said, I mean, because there's better guitar players than me, you know, I think that my strong suit was I knew my history, and I knew how to use my gear, and I knew how to get tones. And I knew if a producer said, yeah, I'm looking for more of like a Kossoff type vibe on the chorus. And like, I knew exactly what he meant, and I knew how to get the sound, you know? And being able to relate to people socially in that way, it makes a big difference.
That helped you as far as when you were making records, it was like very, you were super easy to work with and productive and effective.
Well, it's a communication thing. Mm-hmm. You know, a producer or an artist wants to be able to say, to express themselves in the way that they do and relate, to have somebody relate to them. And so when a producer says, I don't know, I'm looking for something fuzzy and beach ball-y, you know?
Yeah.
Trying to, then you've got to be able to go, okay, what the fuck does he mean by that?
Yeah.
And then saying, okay, I think I get it. I think I know what you're looking for. Check this out, you know, and knowing your gear and how to, it's about communication, I think. You know, that's ultimately what I was trying to get at.
Yeah, I totally see that, man.
And you know, that it's the same, and that's how I got in with the Furs. It wasn't necessarily my playing. It was being able to relate to Richard artistically. When we discussed what turned us on about different music, you know, or art or whatever, you know, it's that ability.
Well, you probably have both thought the other one was authentic in the way that each of you needed to feel that.
And passionate.
Yeah. What prompted you to move to New York City in the first place? And once you got there, how'd you get work? That's not an easy town, as you know.
Well, I was playing with the Furs on a tour. And then afterwards, Richard asked me if I would come to New York. And he was living in New York. And write with him for his solo album. Mm. So I started doing that, and I was still with my old band and having a lot of problems with the singer. We were working on our second record. We're writing our second record. We kept sending demos to the label, trying to get them to give us the green light to go in and record, to record the next album. And we were rehearsing every day, you know, playing gigs on the weekend, still like supporting ourselves in that way. Mm-hmm. And trying to get the singer to show up at rehearsals. So for 6 months, he would not show up at rehearsals, and we were rehearsing every day.
Oh my God.
And then we're sending demos to the label around that time. Meanwhile, nobody wants to be around the singer because he's just a nightmare. And around that time, I got the call from Richard saying, hey, would you be interested in working with me? And I remember going into a band meeting, and the singer showed up, and I had this in my back pocket, you know, knowing, okay, what am I going to, and I didn't know what I was going to do. And I sort of was assessing things. And first thing he came in and said, I've decided I want to record a solo acoustic record. And so that made up my decision for me right there.
Yeah, right, right.
So I moved to New York and started working with Richard on his solo album, which inevitably became the Love Spit Love album. As we were recording, he was like, man, this is not a solo album. This would not be fair of me to call it a solo album because we've done everything together.
That is so cool.
And he said, why don't we just call this a band name and make it a band.
Wow. Is that in your, has it been your experience that most people have done the right thing like that?
No, but most people aren't Richard Butler. I mean, it really depends. It varies. Yeah. It really does.
That's really good. And once you moved to the city, how did you start getting session work?
Well, I think moving to the city with that name cachet of being with associated with the Furs put me in a certain light.
Yep.
So it introduced me to a crowd of people, and people heard what I was doing and or saw me live and then started asking me to be involved in sessions. And I think a lot of it, again, goes back to just meeting people socially. And, I don't know if you're this way, but I generally know what a person's going to play like from talking to them. I know what kind of musician they are just from talking to them 9 out of 10 times. I don't think I've ever had anybody come in and, where I thought, man, I want to work with this guy and been wrong about his playing.
Are you good as far as like reading people? I mean, in general?
I think so. Yeah. I think so.
Where did you develop that?
I don't know. I mean, doesn't everybody think they're good at that?
I don't know.
I don't know either. I think it's a communication thing that, like, you know. I don't know. It's interesting. You can tell what not only if they're competent, but you can tell what kind of player they are.
I've heard that a couple of times. So
man, I firmly believe it. I've been auditioned so many times without picking up an instrument. You know, I think people look at your track record after a while and they basically want to know, can I get along with this guy? Can I do relate to this guy? Mm,
that I totally get. Because you're playing an hour, maybe 2 hours a day. That's the hang for the rest of 22 hours is painful if you can't.
If you can't get along with somebody, Yeah.
Do you have any, what were some of the cooler sessions you worked on in the city?
Oh, man. You know, I used to do all the Puffy stuff, like back in the day. So like all like the Benjamins and that was a cool session actually. That was okay. And it's ironic because I went into that and this is the rock All About the Benjamins track, right? Mm-hmm. So I go in, they have a demo from a band called Perfect. And I was like, I knew that was Tommy Stinson's band because I was a big Replacements fan.
Okay.
I was like, oh, that's Tommy Stinson's new band. They did this demo for that. And it was a killer track, like real sort of Sly and the Family Stone type vibe. And then Dave Grohl came in to play drums.
On that? Tommy's with Tommy Stinson or
no, Tommy wasn't there. They just had a tape, demo of that song that his band had worked up for Puffy. So, and ironically, Tommy and I, a few years later, end up becoming best friends, but, and playing in a band together. But at that time I was just a fan, but Dave Grohl came in And this is before Foo Fighters. Well, no, I guess Foo Fighters had started. But he came in and played drums, and he blew me away. I thought he was just such a phenomenal and versatile drummer and totally killed that track. But yeah, it's a, you know, that was a, I mean, there was a lot, there were so many weird sessions like that. Man, I remember doing a session for RZA.
For who?
Because at that time there was so much hip hop going on in New York, right? So it was RZA and Pink, okay. And they were doing a cover of an INXS song, that Need You Tonight song.
Sure.
And it was the most amateurish thing I'd ever been involved. It was crazy. First of all, he was the stonedest guy I'd ever seen. It was heavy, man. He was so high, and they had no idea about miking or anything like that. You know, they're in this, you know, nice room and nice studio. Just no clue. But stuff like that happened a lot.
That's funny, man. Go ahead.
Yeah, I did a ton. There's so many stories about different sessions.
Get one more. Let's hear one more.
Let me see. Let me think of a different genre. I was actually just talking about this one last night. I did a session for the Tom Tom Club. Tina and Chris from the Talking Heads, right?
Yeah.
And they were doing a remake of their big hit. What was their that song called?
I don't know the Tom Tom Club as well. I know Talking Heads real well. I don't know.
All right. See, now I'm going to have to look it up.
That's totally cool, man. Do it.
Anyways, I go into this session and it's Chris and Tina. They're doing the master of that. The master tape had been damaged and they wanted to use it on like a greatest hits or for a TV commercial or something like that. And so I go in and the part that they had, so I'm hearing all these Adrian Blues part mm-hmm. on that track, the original is just incredible. And then they had this African guitarist that was playing the rhythm part and they'd been through three different guitarists and nobody could cop this feel of this because it's such a weird syncopation and really super staccato strat type sound, like real clean. And it was in the middle of this snowstorm and I had to fly to LA and I had like half an hour to do this session and I had to leave to go catch this flight because the snow was so intense. And it was like this crazy night. I was just talking about this session last night to I actually went out and sat in with these guys, my buddies in Live.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I saw that on social media.
Yeah. So they played last night. So I went out and played with them and we were talking about, because they did their first album with Jerry Harrison.
Oh, okay.
Or not their first album, the Throwing Copper album.
He produced it.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's right. I remember that.
So we were talking about that. We were talking about
that session you did. That's funny, man. Yeah. And I'm assuming you nailed it.
Yeah. Very cool. Were super happy.
Yeah, African music is so rhythmic, you know, very, very much so.
That's not, I did. Okay. So I was in a club one night and playing a gig in New York and.
Dude, I have to ask you only because I'm from there. Which club?
It was in the West Village. What was that place called?
The Bitter End, the Bottom Line.
No, know, further west on Bleecker, like La Strega. Something like, it was just one of those clubs. It might have been like the Red Lion or something like that.
Right, right.
And this friend of mine, actually, she used to be my roommate when I first moved to New York. And she worked, she was an A&R person for my label at that time. And I hadn't seen her for a few years. And so we were catching up. And she's like, hey, what do you know about, what do you know about Ethiopian music?
Well, that's some badass shit.
I don't know much. All I know is I know this singer named Astera Weke I'm in love with. And she goes, oh, my God, why did you say that? And I said, I just know her stuff because she was on Columbia. And she goes, I can't believe you just said that. I'm doing a record with her right now. And she wants to use like some American musicians.
Wow.
You'd be perfect for this. And I'm like, I am so in. And so I ended up doing this incredible record with her. And it was super cool. That was a great session because I got to play with these African musicians. And, you know, I met with her again. I auditioned by just going and meeting with her.
Sure.
And her husband, and just fell in love with her. I was just like, and we just, so we had like this, you know, love affair thing, you know, it was just music, you know?
Sure.
And just related in that regard, just as humans. And so it was a great record. Was it? You know, but she never listened to me play before. She never, I don't know if she ever listened to any other music that I'd done or, you know, but we went in the studio and made this great record.
But that's so cool. Like, you know, right there, man, when you mentioned her name, the universe was like extremely supportive of that whole project. Like of all the things that the names that, right? You pull out, right? I mean, that's so cool when that happens.
I know. And legit, that was the only one I knew. I mean, that was all I knew about Ethiopian music. And I was obsessed with these two records that she'd done on Columbia. Yeah, and she's like the Aretha Franklin of Ethiopia.
Man, I am sure you've told this story like dozens and dozens of times, but if you're comfortable telling it once more, and if not, that's totally cool. But for people that haven't heard it that are listening, how'd you get the call for Guns N' Roses? And again, if you're tired of telling it, that's totally cool. We can go to the next question.
No. I was on tour with Enrique Iglesias. And this was like during his heyday of like when he was massive. Mm-hmm. And like Hero had just come out, and we did that whole 9/11 had just happened, and we did that tribute to Heroes, and it was like he was just huge. And so I'd been doing this tour with him for a year and a half or so, 2 years, and we did like Royal Albert Hall in London, and I got the call. Well, originally I got the call before then. I was in New York and I was going out. They called me and said, hey, would you be interested? The management called me and said, would you be interested in auditioning for Guns N' Roses? And I didn't know anybody in the camp, but I was like, yeah, sure, I guess so. I said, well, I'm going to be in LA next week. Maybe we could do it then. And they said, oh, perfect. So we set it up. A couple days before, I called to get information on where it's going to be and all that, and I never get a call back. So I thought that was weird, and I get out. So I got out to LA to do this other session, to this other album, and on the session was Tommy Stinson and Josh Fries, who were both playing with GNR at that time. And I was like, man, I can't believe you guys are doing this session, because I was supposed to coming to audition for GNR. And they said, oh, you're the guy from New York. Oh, right. Okay. And they go, oh, that's so funny. Well, Axel found this guy, Buckethead, and we just called off all the auditions. And I was like, okay, cool. So Tommy and I went out that night, became best buddies, you know, best friends. So now 2 years later, I get a call from Tommy going, hey, man, can you come audition for Guns? Sure. Let me figure it out, because I'm in Europe. And turned, so I sorted it out. I got off stage from the last show in at Royal Albert Hall, had a car waiting, went to the airport, flew to LA, got off the plane, went straight to the audition, did the audition, hung out with Axel all night talking and listening to music in his car, and then went back to the airport and flew back to finish the tour.
Holy shit. Hold on a minute. This is like all flew from the UK to do the straight to LA and then straight into the audition.
Yeah. Dude. And then back to Ireland to pick up, you know, cause I had 2 days off or the day and a half off, whatever, you know? So
yeah,
it was my only window.
Wow.
Yeah. And then Axel at the audition, when we were hanging out, he's like, so we're going to start rehearsing in 2 weeks because we got this thing coming up. And I was like, whoa, I can't leave the tour that I'm on. And he was like, what? Like, I'm just, in his mind, he's thinking, what? I'm asking you to join Guns N' Roses and you can't leave the Enrique Iglesias tour. And he thought about it for a second. He goes, okay, well, wait, because I know you won't do it to me.
Yeah, you know, yeah, of course.
You know, because I you have to honor your commitments, right?
Absolutely.
Which, you know, has gotten me into trouble in the past because if I say I'm going to do something, you know, even if it's a free gig, you know, I had to cancel the tour one time because I'd committed to doing a gig for no money, but I gave him my word. I told him I'd do it. You know, I've always sort of run by that.
I mean, you got to do it. What, when you wake up and look in the mirror, man, you got, it's a lot easier to just be consistent with that. You know,
I remember hearing a story about, I won't bring up names, but somebody that was playing with this band, this friend of mine, playing with a friend of mine's band, and the other successful band, they're playing, and they're in the middle of a tour. He gets a call from Rod Stewart, has to go and decides he's going to leave and go do that gig, and totally screwed this band over because they're in the middle of a tour and he leaves. And you hear stories about that. And, you know, once you do that a couple of times, people just won't hire you.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And he has that you know, that guy now has that reputation. You know, there's certain players that are great players, but they're just unscrupulous in that way, and people won't hire him for obvious reasons.
Sure, I totally get that, man. Hey, I don't know if you could answer this, but would it be possible? I mean, you've been involved in a lot of cool projects. Is it possible for you to pick, like, the top three experiences you've had musically, either because of the work you did personally or the hang, the richness of the experience, the personalities involved?
Touring wise, playing with Thin Lizzy was like, you know, that was, to play guitar harmonies with Scott Gorham was pretty up there. Mm. Man, I've had so many great experiences. I've been really lucky. But that one is one that sticks out. Like, every night was just so much fun to play those songs that were so important to me as a young kid, you know, when I was first falling in love with rock and roll.
Sure.
You know, that was huge. Man, touring with, when I was with the Dead Daisies and we toured with Charlie Drayton playing drums and Daryl Jones on bass, that was also just an incredible experience. Every night was just this.
I'm sorry, man. You broke up just the last thing.
I just said that was so much fun. It was like an adventure in music every night because it was different every night.
Because of the tightness of those guys in the rhythm section?
Because it was so pure and so, you know, it was driven, you know, the songs would be different every night and have a different feel because that's how the guys roll. That's how Charlie rolls, you know? Mm. And so it's very pure. It's where he's coming from that night, what he's feeling from the crowd. And that's what it became. So it was very organic in that sense. And that was such an incredible learning experience.
In what way?
Just because you're music is a conversation when it's at its purest form. And that's what that was every night. It was a communication between all of us. It was sort of like what you and I are doing right now.
Yeah, okay. Yeah.
And it's a conversation that happens in public for people to witness.
That's a great, I've never really heard that put like that, but that is a really good analogy. It's a conversation in public for other people to witness.
But it's so rare nowadays. I mean, I suppose you have it with your jam bands, and that was, I guess, the attraction of like bands like the Grateful Dead and things like that, because that's, albeit long-winded conversations. and the same with jazz, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah. You have a theme.
But jazz, it may be in a different language sometimes.
Yeah, but you have a theme. Totally. You know, you've got a head, right? You've got the melody, you've got the theme, and then so you riff off of that theme. You're discussing, you've got a question written down that you're going to ask me. So you're asking me that question. We could have this conversation, for every day for the next couple of months, and the answers would be different.
Yeah. Totally.
And you would try and elicit a different response because you don't want to hear the same stories again.
Yes.
Okay. Totally. So that's what Charlie does. And he really drives when he's, he drives the engine. So he's going to lead it in a different way because he wants to hear a different response,
Yeah. That's really cool, man. That makes your life so much more interesting, man.
Tell me about it. That's the beauty of Guns N' Roses. I mean, that's why that band for me is so much fun to play with. And it's so different than when you're in a situation where you're playing the same songs in the exact same way every night. And that's so much of what music has become.
Yeah.
And that's sad. I think but, then there's bands that don't do it that way. There's bands like, the Flaming Lips or bands like Tame Impala, where they are trying to keep that going,
Sure.
In Guns N' Roses, there are those moments that are open-ended questions, right? That are open-ended conversations. And then there are the things that are the same every night.
Sure.
But those moments somehow open it up and make it, I don't know, it affects the entire night.
In a good way, right?
In a way that even the parts that are exactly the same are still more, we're in tune with each other as far as supporting each other and who is taking the focus at or who's directing the conversation at that point. You know what I mean? Yeah. And so I think we're more supportive because we're all listening and we're tuned, and man, I've done so many tours where, you're playing at tracks and it's not really a conversation. No one's really necessarily listening to each other. They're listening to what they need to hear to be tight with what's going on.
Yeah, I get it. That sucks. I saw a concert. I'm not going to say who it is on the air, but I saw a concert recently and it was like that. It was horrible, man. I the guitar player who I really love, I'd never seen him live before. It was really disappointing because he just there was zero emotion coming out of him. He was just like collecting tolls, like it was so his motions were so mechanical. It was like, oh my God. I just said, I hope this is an off night for the guy, or maybe something's going on, or maybe he's feeling ill or something like that. But I was like, oh my God, this is really disappointing. Where, you know, you could tell, like you just said, it wasn't authentic. It was like,
right. You know, he's sort of phoning it in, man. But you know what? It's the situation. I mean, I've done gigs like that, and I'll tell you, those gigs are the ones that feel like a job.
Yeah.
You know, and sometimes those tours are with bands that the other players are phenomenal players, but for whatever reason, they're, you know, people want to hear if pop tours, you know, they want to hear it sound like the record, and they want to hear, you know, little variations, and but those, they're the same every night, they're completely scripted, and you know, that's just it. Those gigs are, it feels like a job.
It is. I mean, and look, I think we all, in whatever business you're in, some gigs you have to take just to pay the bills. You know, that's just the reality of it. Not every gig, I think, no matter what you do, is going to be like, oh, wow, this is exciting. Not every single
one. But you don't know when you get into it, you know?
Yeah.
So you commit to doing a tour because of the people that are involved. And you think, okay, cool. You know, it's going to be cool because I'm going to learn something, because I'm going to be playing with these guys, and you know, they're great players. So, you know, and then you get into it, and after a couple of weeks, you're like, yeah, this is, you know, this is a job. Mm-hmm. And, you know, then hopefully you're able to move on and do something else, you know, or you don't. I don't know. I guess I've been very fortunate in that way. When I've gotten into situations like that, I have not found it difficult to get myself out.
That's great. Let me ask you this. You're a super optimistic guy, so I don't want to bring your head down, but what were some of the lower points or the more challenging times of your career, and how did you manage to get through them? And how did you manage to, like, you know, fight off any sort of negative messages that you might have been receiving at the time?
You know, I've been really very, very fortunate, and in that I haven't really struggled. You know, I haven't, or at least when I mean, I might not have been making a lot of money, but I was working all the time. And to me, not working is a struggle.
Hell, you know? Yeah.
So I guess it's never felt like I've been, like, I've never had to work a real job, you know. I've never had to wait tables, or, you know, I've never had to do anything like that. So since I was a kid, since I have been a professional musician, I've always gone to bigger gigs, I guess, you know.
That's fantastic. So let me ask you this as a follow-up.
That's not true. Actually, that's not true. That's not true. I've done smaller tours, but they were because I wanted to do them. So if that makes sense.
No, it totally makes sense. So let me ask you this. Why do you think that is? Because not every music, I mean, if there is a why, maybe it's just, you know, this is your destiny kind of thing and that's it. And you just put your head down and did what you're supposed to do. And you know, it all worked out, which happens once in a while. But do you think there's a reason why?
I don't know. You know, I never lived beyond my means. I always kept my nut very low. So I didn't have to struggle for gigs. And, you know, when I was doing sessions for a while in New York, I was making more money. I couldn't afford a tour because I was making too much money in the studios. And then I started my own business because I was doing a lot of jingle work, right? I was doing a lot of sessions for commercials and things like that. And then I was like, man, then I started getting asked to demo on my own for commercials. So And then I landed a couple of really big ones. And then I had this company that's what we did. And meanwhile, I was still doing sessions for different people, and I was able to work around those with my own business, you know. But I couldn't afford to go on the road.
Yeah.
Because it would cost you
money.
Right.
Yeah.
And in certain circumstances, like with Love Spit Love or The Furs, I would find a way to do it because I love doing it. It's a nice balance, you know? Mm-hmm. But yeah, it was difficult for me. I turned down a lot of tours. But it was, I don't know. It was, I never felt, I enjoy both elements, you know, recording and being on the road equally, I think.
Do you still do the licensing? Are you still doing stuff like that?
No, it's few and far between. And the money is just, it's, you know, now what you get for a commercial when it goes final is what we used to get for demos.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, it's just a totally, it's a total different world, you know, to what it was back then.
Hey, let's talk gear for a few minutes.
Man, but I want to say, but the I think the reason that is because there's so many musicians now that are doing it and undercutting each other because everybody has a studio in their house. And, you know, even if you're in an apartment in New York, you still have a studio because all you need is a computer, a couple of good mic pre's and a couple of good mics and, you know, you can do it all in the box. And people are saying, hey, I'll do it for $5,000. I'll do it for $3,000, you know? And so it's, you know, that's just what it's become.
I understand that. Yeah. I think it's, unfortunately, I think it's like that in every business. You always have people that are just like giving stuff away and it really, devalues the product.
Yeah. And all the guys that were doing what I did, you know, were making a living playing sessions, you know, you're not surviving doing that anymore because it's just that work is not there. The labels don't have budgets like they used to, you know. And so it just trickles down.
And you said when you lived in the city, you lived on the Lower East Side, right?
Yeah, I still love my apartment on the Lower East Side.
That's cool over there.
Yeah, I own it. I rent it out right now. But I still go back to New York quite a bit for work, just to do sessions and stuff.
For session work. That's great, yeah. Man. That's really cool. I love the city, man. The energy there is just
absolutely
off the charts.
Most of my album session work is done at home now, you know, because I have, and really it's ideal because I've got, you know, I've got a Pro Tools rig and I mean, I've had one for the last 20 years, but now I can do, you know, you can do sessions. I've got great microphones. I've got great preamps. I've got every guitar amp known to man. I've got an incredible guitar collection. I've got a million pedals. So it's all here. And, you know, when you go to do a session, you've got to pick.
Oh, and you got to schlep all that stuff with you, man.
Yeah, or have it parted there, you know. And in New York, you know, it was a major issue because they had a cartridge company that would take – they'd be taking one set of amps to one studio, you know, amps and guitars. And then I'd travel with, you know, and assorted pedals. And then I'd have to run back to my studio, grab more pedals that I wanted to use for the next session while the cartridge company was setting up the gear at the next place. And that's just sort of how it worked, you know, and most, you know, in the morning I'd spend the day going over what was going to go where, what gear I wanted to go where with my cartridge company. And yeah, it was just different times.
Yeah. Logistics is tough in New York, man, for doing almost anything.
But, you know, I had it worked out. I had a system but now, man, it's so much easier just to have all my gear at home and a live room, and you know, you go in and pick out what you want. And, but anyways, that leads us to gear.
Yeah, man. You got some awesome guitars. What would you say right now, not for studio work, I mean, just the guitar you like, what's your go-to guitar? Yeah.
Okay. It's in my hands right now.
Oh, nice.
I just bought this 53 gold top that is my favorite thing in the world. Like it is, I'm so madly in love with this guitar.
Get out. It's of all the Les Pauls you have, that's your favorite one now?
It's a 53. Well, I mean, this week it's a 53 and it's, it's just so alive and so incredible sounding. God,
I want to turn on the camera just to see this for one second, and then we'll turn it back off. I want to see it.
Okay, hold on.
Yeah. Oh, nice, man.
Wrap around, and it's, look how clean that
is. It's so clean. I cannot believe it. It's still full gold and everything. Oh my God.
It is so vibey. It's like, it's just so much fun to play. I can't stop. It's just amazing, man. It was, I sat in with the live guys last night and I wanted to bring this so badly and, I couldn't because I was going to play with them and then I was going to go see Robert Plant who was playing at this club. But I didn't want to leave this in my car neighborhood because St. Louis is where everybody's gear gets stolen.
Wow, what a beautiful guitar.
Isn't it awesome?
Let me turn this back off because it already started chopping. So let me ask you, did you get that in St. Louis?
No, I got it from CME, from Chicago Music Exchange.
Wow, awesome. Congratulations, man. I hope you have many years of playing that. That's a beautiful guitar.
I bought another guitar not long ago from them as well. Man, I find some great stuff through those guys. And they're such great people. I love that place.
Do you just have like an ongoing open list with them? Like if this comes in, call me. If that comes in.
The owner's a really good friend of mine. And so, yeah, when I, you know, if I'm looking for something, I put it out there. And yeah, they just come across so much great stuff. But I bought a 64 Casino, Epiphone Casino.
Oh, yeah. Everybody I know has those, loves
man,
them.
Man, they're magical. And I bought a 60 Dotneck from them that I am also in love with. And that's become sort of my PAF go-to for recording.
So tell me the difference between the Epiphone and the Dot, like and sonically feel.
Yeah, completely different. I mean, first of all, the Dotneck is a 335, so it has the center block, and it's got PAFs. The Casino is P90s, hollow, completely hollow. There's no center block.
Okay, I didn't
realize that. Which is cool. You know, it's very cool. It's very vibey.
So are those like your top three right now that you like?
Well, I mean,
is it possible? Like if I asked you that question in 5 minutes, you'd probably give me three different ones, right?
Maybe. So I just got this guitar that was made by this guy in Italy. It's called a Paoletti, and he wanted to make me a guitar. So we were talking back and forth and I wanted him to make me sort of a Les Paul shape, like a junior, but with a Tele bridge, a left-handed Tele bridge. And then I wanted a left-handed Tele neck on it. So there's more tension on the low strings and the angle of the pickup, the bridge pickup is reversed.
Very cool.
Which I think were the two major. I do that with all my Strats and Teles, because I think it was a design flaw, and I think that Henrik's got it right.
Got that guitar?
It's fucking beautiful. And I just got it a few days ago, so I played that last night, and it sounded great. And I played through one of those new Bonamassa twins that Chad has from Live.
Oh yeah,
and I have a I have a low power and a high power original Tweed Twins. And man, the Bonamassa I thought sounded great.
This is like, is every week like this, man? Or is this like Christmas? This is Christmas in September for you with guitars, no?
No, it comes in waves, I think, you know?
That's awesome, man. Well, I'm glad you're having a good wave right now. That sounds like fun.
But I, and I got this, I got a 58-6119 Gretsch, which is the single pickup. Mm-hmm. Nashville Chet Atkins. It's on the cover of the first Chet Atkins album. Mm-hmm. Red. I got a mint one of those, and wow. I traded this guy. Got it. It was a great deal.
That's awesome, man. How does that? How do the Gretches sound? Those old Gretches. What do they sound like?
Man, okay. I have a 58-6120 too, and they are phenomenal recording guitars. Difficult to use live. The old ones are, I think they're pretty much virtually impossible, at least for me, to use live.
Why is that? But,
The bridges aren't pinned. The pickups are very low output. So if you're switching guitars, it's very difficult.
Yeah.
But if you're in the studio and you can crank up an amp all the way and really juice it, there's so much definition and clarity to those old pickups. And the 58s are the before they actually said PAF on them, before they said patent applied for, mm-hmm. and obviously before the patent numbers. But there was nothing on the covers. And man, those pickups are incredible. So I have two of those now. I have the 6119 that I just got and the 6120. And you know, the Who were just doing shows with us. this is pretty crazy, but the Who actually was supporting us in South America.
That is fucking cool.
That's difficult to get your head around.
Yeah. I mean,
at least it was for us. It just seems so wrong. You know, it's like, wait, the Who were playing before us? You know, it was just so weird.
And it was Townsend, Daltrey.
Yeah. So I was talking to Townsend and his tech, Alan Rogan, who I've known for a long time. And we were talking about recording. And he's like, oh, yeah, you know, I love the – because he was admiring my Gretches that I tour with. And I was talking about how much I love the new Gretches. And he said, yeah, you know, I've used a 6120 in the studio since 73. That's all I record with.
Wow.
So all those great Who albums, like Who's Next, and those were all a 6120.
Are you serious? That was all with a Gretsch?
Yeah.
Wow. I got to go back.
Apparently that's common knowledge, and I just didn't know it for some time.
Who's Next is one of the greatest albums ever made. I mean, in my opinion, I think it's one of the greatest albums ever made.
You know, I worked with Andy Johns, who's Glyn Johns' brother, mm-hmm. who did all the great albums. And Andy told me that, because Andy and I used to work together a lot, and he was a really, really great friend of mine, and sadly has passed, but he was one of the greatest engineers, the single greatest engineer I've ever worked with and ever witnessed. Just incredible. But his brother did all those great Who albums, and he said that his brother would always say the hardest part of his job was trying to beat Pete's demos.
Wow, that's pretty. Yeah. Well, he's such a genius, Townsend, you know?
Absolutely. So that 6120 that he's been recording with since the early 70s was given to him by Joe Walsh after the James Gang was on tour opening for The Who. At the end of the tour, he gave him that guitar.
Holy shit. What a history, man.
Yeah. Wow. So that's 58, I believe, that he was using.
It's a 58. So Joe Walsh has given a lot of people guitars.
I know, right? man, I want to be Joe Walsh's friend.
I think you should be Joe Walsh's friend for sure.
Man, I am such a huge Joe Walsh fan, like legit James Gang. Man, one of my all-time favorites. Such an underrated guitar player.
I agree.
Damn.
And he's
always had an incredible tone, whether it's through like Bandmasters or like small Gibson amps. Like he's the one I saw him playing through like these small Tweed Gibsons and was like, man, I have to get. And so I started lusting after these Tweed Gibsons, which if you're not hip to those, are total Fender destroyers. Like,
okay, what year are you talking about these Gibsons from?
Like 50, you know, mid 50s to late 50s. Like the Deluxe Killer, which is like the Ranger or the Explorer or what's the other one? Ranger, Explorer. They're 112, single 12, like a Deluxe. But man, they sound, they're so tight and there's just this raspy, you know?
So they're mid to late 50s Gibson amps, 1x12, and they're what are they called? Deluxe.
Well, one of them's a Ranger and one of them's Explorer. I think the Explorer has like the tremolo and reverb. The Ranger is just like straight without eye. But yeah, those 112 amps are just incredible.
What is it, like 18, 24 watts, something like that?
Yeah, they're low wattage.
Wow, very cool.
Yeah, like Deluxe.
Thank you, man. I wasn't hip to those at all. Man, do you have any interesting stories about how you acquired any of your guitars? Like a Joe Walsh story or something?
Not really anything exciting. Man, Ricky Medlock has them. You got to interview
Ricky. I'm interviewing Ricky Friday.
No way!
Yeah.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Well, yeah. Do you have a question for him?
No, Ricky's my boy. We talk all the time.
Yeah, I'm interviewing him Friday morning at 11 o'clock.
Okay, so tell him Fortis said it wanted me to ask you, or you to tell me the story about how you found your Burst.
Okay.
And then, and your Explorer.
Okay, Burst and Explorer. How funny is that, man?
That motherfucker still tours with that. So I saw him, 2 weeks ago, they were playing the same place I played last night with Live. Skinner was playing there, right? Mm-hmm. So we're there hanging out, and Ricky, we're talking. I'm showing my wife his Explorer. I'm like, this is a $500,000 guitar, and he's playing it live every night. And he's like, man, you know, that guitar's part of me. It's just that's part of who I am. It's like I have to play it. I love that.
Plus,
And it's he uses that vibrola. Have you ever played a vibrola?
I have not, but I was just reading that about him when I was doing the research for his interview.
You can't keep those in tune. He uses the hell out of it and it stays perfectly in tune. I mean, that guitar is just it. And he was like, man, I'm going to will it to you. And I'm like, and I turned to my wife, who's an attorney. I said, you witnessed this.
But you know, I was with
Andrew from Chicago Music Exchange, and he's like, I'm a witness.
That's funny, man. The thing is, with Ricky.
So when you talk to Ricky, say, hey, Florida says you're willing him your Explorer.
I will. I just wrote it down, man. I will ask him all of that. And when it goes live, I'll send it to you too.
Man, he is the best. He is such a cool guy.
That's so funny.
When I first met Ricky, I was on tour. I was doing a tour with the Dead Daisies, and we were supporting Skinner and Bad Company. Mm-hmm. And
wow, what a tour.
And so we're backstage the first day of the tour, and Ricky looks at, I see Ricky looking over at me, and he goes, hey, man. And I'm like, oh, shit, here it comes. And he goes, you used to play with Thin Lizzy? And I said, yes, sir, I did. He said, I thought that was you. So he goes, man, I was watching you on the TV the other night. So that's how Ricky and I met.
The thing is with Ricky, I know it's like he's carrying around a $500,000 guitar, but you just get this feeling that if anybody ever stole that, they'd be so much worse.
Oh,
in their, like, Ricky would somehow make sure that this, you know, whatever happened to them was so much worse than anything that could have happened. So,
okay, that you have to ask Ricky to tell you the story about Def Leppard when they were opening for him.
Okay.
And I don't know if it was Blackfoot or Skinner, but I guess it would have been Blackfoot, right? When they were first starting out. And
yeah,
Def Leppard was just starting out.
Yeah, it was Blackfoot.
And he gets to the gig and the opening band's not on. And he's like, what the fuck's going on? Oh, the guitar player is in his dressing room when he won't come out. Why? I don't know. He's crying about something. Crying? What? But he'll tell you the story. It's great.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to talking with him. Man.
He's That's one so of my funny. Favorite people.
That's so cool. How funny is that I'm interviewing him this week?
That's crazy.
Yeah, it is crazy, man.
So that same night, my buddy, they were playing. Now, this is the genius of booking agents and management companies. They are managed by the same company that manages Blackberry Smoke.
Okay, yeah.
Charlie
and Paul, I interviewed those guys, man, too. Great guys.
Charlie's one of my favorite people in the world, yeah, and one of my absolute favorite guitar players. So they were booked on the same night in St. Louis, playing an outdoor amphitheater, like a few miles from where Skinner's playing there. Like, who would do that? Why would you book?
Yeah.
Anyways, so since it's the farewell tour, my wife had never seen Skinner, so. Mm-hmm. We went to see Skinner. And, you know, I was going to go out to lunch with Ricky and Charlie because they know each other as well. But scheduling wise, it didn't work out. So I ended up going out, spending the day out with Charlie, going to look at guitars and stuff, vintage guitars in St. Louis. And then we hooked up later with Ricky that night.
Yeah, those guys, I'll send you that interview, man. Charlie talked about getting sober in there and everything. It was a pretty good interview, man. I think it's actually one of the most popular, if not the most popular interview I've done.
Man, that guy is, I'm seriously one of the greatest musicians I know. Yeah. He's just such a pure soul.
Yeah, good guy.
I'm really I love him.
Good writer.
But, absolutely. Absolutely.
Well, along the same lines, man. Name a couple of players that you've enjoyed jamming with and maybe one or two you'd like to jam with.
Charlie.
you've enjoyed or would like to?
No, I have enjoyed.
You've played with Charlie. Okay.
Yeah. No, I love that guy. Yeah. I love the band. But yeah, I've been so lucky. I've gotten to play with so many great people. God, it's impossible to be put on the spot and think of, like,
hey man, what a great problem to have. I'm glad you got your problem,
right?
Man. Good for you.
Man, dude, I got to jam with Angus Young.
Did you
Nobody
really?
Can say that. Nobody can say that. I've played with him many times. Yeah. We share a singer.
What's he like when you're playing with him? Energy-wise. Yeah.
It's all you're doing is supporting him. You know, you're supporting the song and him. He's a ball of energy, man. He's Angus Young.
Yeah.
He's a force.
He really is.
Yeah, it's incredible. I mean, and he, the first time we played with him, he came out in the suit.
Oh, man.
Man, I'm looking at Duff and Slash, and we're all looking at each other, and Frank, and we're all looking at each other like, oh my God, we're playing with Angus.
Frank Sidoris?
Frank Ferrer, our drummer. And you know, I've been playing with Frank since 94. Mm. No, before then. Because he was in a band called The Beautiful. And they supported my first band, Pale Divine, in the Midwest on some shows, right? And then I was walking down the street. I was working with Butler on that Love Spit Love album, the first Love Spit Love album, we were writing it, and we were auditioning drummers to put together a band to record the album. And I was walking down the street, and I saw him closing up St. Mark's Leather, this shoe shop.
That's so funny.
And I'm like, hey, I know you. He's like, hey, man, what's going on? And I'm going, what's going on with the Beautiful? He's like, oh, we just broke up. And I said, really? We're looking for drummers. Yeah, so we played. He got that gig. So Love Spit Love, and then we started the Furs up again. He came, played with the Furs. Then he toured with the Dead Daisies. He toured with, we had a band together called Honky Toast that was on Epic. That's a really cool record. We've done so much stuff together.
But how nutty is it? And this always, I mean, this is just how life works, but it always boggles my mind that if you would have left or he would have closed up that shop 5 minutes later, like none of that might have even happened. Yeah, yeah. I mean, isn't that, I mean, honestly, that is.
Man, isn't that, that's the beauty of life.
It's fucking amazing. I mean, there's, you know, that's when I hear stuff like that.
I don't know, man. You know, it's almost as if I expect it in a way now. Like my life has been so much like that.
That's great, man. That's really cool.
And I'm surrounded by people that happens to all the time. I mean, I know it sounds weird, but.
No, it doesn't. It doesn't. I think a lot of that has to do with your own outlook on what you expect out of the world. You know, and how comfortable, not like expect as in entitled, but like how confident you are that the universe is just going to take care of you, that everything's going to work out.
Exactly. That's exactly it. You know? That's exactly it.
Do you remember the first record you ever purchased?
I remember, well, honestly, the first ones were Columbia Records and Tapes.
Of the Columbia Music Club.
Yep. I convinced my mom to give me the $12 or whatever.
Yeah.
And I mean, I was a little kid. And I remember I bought Aerosmith Rocks. Because you could pick 12, right?
Or you
could
pick something. You know, I like think that. I got Rocks from them also, to be honest with you.
I got Beach Boys, Pet Sounds. I got Simon and Garfunkel. War.
Bridge Over Troubled Water.
I think it was a greatest hits. Mm. What else? Oh, Kiss Alive 1.
Great record.
And then, yeah, so I think that those were like the first ones. I forget what else was in that group. But then I remember when Love Gun came out, I walked to the store. I'd been saving money and I walked up to the store, bought it, and it was the dead of summer, right? And so I walked up, got it, put down my $12, whatever it was, got home, opened the record, and it was completely warped because I walked in the sun.
Oh, man, I remember those days. Remember that when you put a warped record, that would really suck because you put a warped record on and you'd like actually watch it. It would be so horrifying, you know, like,
because and you try and weight the needle down with like a quarter or something.
Or then you'd try to put it in the sun underneath a stack of books and thinking it would fix it.
No, I never tried that.
Yeah, we used to do shit like that.
It didn't work, did it?
No. Oh, man. What if I asked you to pick top three, I mean, just for now, man, Desert Island Disc, no particular order and knowing it could change tomorrow. I know this is tough.
I mean, just like off the top of my head, I'd say Pet Sounds, Beggar's Banquet, and man, I don't know. Man, Wired or Blow by Blow comes to mind, but I'd have to. It would probably be a Beatles record,
man, it's just three, Rich.
Damn it!
You're getting carried away here now.
Physical Graffiti,
great record. A lot of people have picked that one. Actually, a lot of people picked Beggar's Banquet. I think it's the first time I've heard Pet Sounds.
Really?
Surprisingly, yeah.
Oh my God, that record still makes me cry. It came on last night when we were driving. It's just like, God, I'm just always completely floored by the beauty of that record.
Is Sloop John B is on that, right?
No.
Oh, it's not? I love that Beach Boys song.
Yeah, it's a great song.
What's the most important things that you've learned about yourself throughout your career experience and through life in general?
I don't know. I mean, again, I think if you asked me 10 minutes from now, it would be different. But what we were just talking about being open to the universe and knowing that I'm going to be all right. You know, knowing that I'm always going to be in the presence of like-minded individuals.
You had a good childhood, I would imagine, right? Because generally, when that comes so naturally to you, that's what it means. Or maybe not.
I don't know. You know, it's funny because I was talking to my kid's therapist about that, and she's like, how did you get to be this way? Because she knows my mom. Mm. And I don't know. I think you just are who you are. You know, and as a parent, I think you can relate to that, right?
Well,
my kids are who they are. They've always been who they were. It didn't have anything to do with me. I mean, of course, elements, but they are who they are.
Yeah, but don't you think that, like, the environment you grow up in has a huge influence on how you process, you know, your coping skills or your outlook on things?
Yeah, I guess so.
Your expectations of things. Not that you can't change those moving forward.
I guess so.
Yeah, and it just seems like whenever, because I'm pretty good, you know, sort of reading people, and when I have seen people that, you know, have this very not forced attitude, the way you are, you're like very easy about it, you know, not entitled, but it's not forced either, that, you know, hey, I'm comfortable, I know everything's going to work out. Generally, I've noticed that usually comes from a super stable childhood. Now, maybe yours wasn't, and you just somehow switched that around.
No, you know, I'm not. I definitely didn't have a difficult childhood, I don't think. I mean, it was just, I don't know. You know, I grew up in the suburbs, and but we were all delinquents, you know, at that. But that was just sort of the time, you know, with drugs and.
But that's you decision. That's a decision. Right. You know, that does. What I'm talking about is the environment you grew up in.
It was the delinquency. I mean, it was a me decision for sure, you know?
Yeah. I mean, unless it was a response to, like, right, there was fucked up shit going on at home and you had to escape.
So you're probably right.
Well, that's just something I've observed, you know, and you have it like very natural, man. Very like, you know, very, what's the word? You know, it's very natural for you. Very, you're calm about it. You know, it's you're wired into your DNA like that. It's almost.
Yeah, it is what it is, right?
Yeah. Yeah. But it's good, you know, it's good the way it is, I think, for you. Tell me something about yourself that people would either be surprised to hear or might find a little odd.
I don't know, because I don't know that anybody thinks about me. I don't know. That's a tough one. Yeah, I mean, what would you say? What's something about you that your listeners don't know about you?
That they don't know about me?
Well, that would surprise them.
That's a good question, Rich.
I didn't ask it. You did.
Well, you asked it to me. I asked.
I just turned it around.
You just put the mirror up. Something about me that's, oh man, there's a lot. I had very bad communication skills when I was younger.
Really?
Horrible. I didn't know how to get along with anybody, literally anybody.
Were you an only child?
No, I was the oldest of three.
Huh.
Terrible upbringing. So I had to learn how to like sort of do all that on my own. Like now I can talk to like a soap dish and like have the dish talk back. But that, and yeah.
I'm a perfect example of that soap dish.
that would probably be surprising that I did not know how to speak, really bad communication skills, didn't know how to deal with people at all.
Oh, that is surprising.
Yeah. Probably, I figured that would be surprising.
Wow, that's a trip. Yeah, it's weird. I've been asked that before. I don't know. It's so hard for me to think about how people perceive me, or you know.
Oh yeah, yeah.
And it's weird because we were. It's so difficult for me to really get my head around the fact that I stand on stage in front of 80,000 people a night. Like, that's just so difficult.
Way?
It's just to think that there are that many people looking at you at one given moment.
Yeah.
And trying to figure out like and making evaluations or thinking about what kind of person you are, what, you know, how mysterious it may be. I don't know. It's really strange, you know?
Yeah. Well, it's funny because I was talking to another artist and they were saying something about it's really weird because when you meet people like, you know, like VIP type things or just whatever. He said a lot of times, or in the people see in the street, people have this relationship with you, which like may not have anything to do with, you know, who they really are.
Yeah, it is. It's bizarre because people always say, wow, I never thought you would be so nice. You're like a normal guy. What the fuck does that mean? Like,
that's the answer to your question.
What kind of, I mean, what you think about, and so you take that into consideration, then you think about there's, you know, 60 to 80,000, right, whatever people want, you know, all have this, whatever their images of you, based on the YouTube videos that they've watched and based on the, you know, how they perceive you on stage and how that reflects your character. It's interesting.
It is interesting, man. And I think like for me, one of the things, the reasons I think that this show has worked is because I have none of those images because I know that we're all like, you're super well, you have a craft that you've excelled in, but you know, you have the same things going on in your life that I do and everybody else does. You know, you want your kids to be healthy and okay. All right. Three questions left, Rich. Happiest moment or time in your life?
When my daughters were born.
Very cool. Most important thing your dad and mom taught you?
You know, I think the thing that sticks with me is that my father once said to me, he said, you are blessed because you're able to do what you love and you would be doing it for free if you weren't getting paid for it.
Yeah, for sure, man. And mom, anything in particular she said?
No.
All right, man. Last question. Can you talk about a specific experience that changed your life a little bit or altered the way you think about things?
Well, I mean, being a parent definitely changes everything because you're living for somebody else, not for yourself anymore.
Very true, man. Well, man, Richard, I can't thank you enough for your time. This has been great. I really appreciate everything, man. And anything you want to promote or anything like that?
No. I'm excited for you to interview Ricky, though.
Thanks. I just made a note, and I'm going to send it. I'll send you his interview when it comes out, man. Everybody, thanks for listening. If you enjoyed this interview, please share it with a friend or on your social media channels. We appreciate your support and your help with this. Thanks again to Richard Fortas for spending time with us. I really appreciate it. And make sure you go to the homepage of everyonelovesguitar.com. Sign up to get on our newsletter list. You'll get advance notice of guests coming on the show, as well as the opportunity to ask them your own questions. And most important, remember that happiness is a choice, so choose wisely. Be nice. Go play your guitar and have fun. Till next time, peace and love, everybody. I'm out. I hope you enjoyed this episode of Everyone Loves Guitar. If you did, make sure you go to everyonelovesguitar.com/subscribe and subscribe to the audio podcast and to our very active YouTube community. And if you have any comments, please write me at everyonelovesguitar.com/hello. We'll see you on the next episode. Until then, make sure you choose happiness. Relax and have as much fun as possible.